annual average deaths in collective violence are about 1.5 per 100,000 globally. For homicide, it's a little over 7.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. We're very focused on war and its consequences at the moment. We see its impact on our TVs every night. But what if someone told you that most of us underestimate the costs of violence in the world by an order of magnitude and neglect many ways to reduce violence and all its costs? That's the argument of a new book called Worse Than War, The Global Costs of Violence, by Anke Höfler of the University of Konstanz and Jim Fearon of Stanford. Jim joins me now. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Jim.
Thank you. Hello, Tim.
Jim, the book title, Worse Than War. When people think about violence, well, they immediately think about wars. What type of violence is worse than war?
Interpersonal violence. The major forms of which that we focus on the most in the book are homicide, intimate partner violence, including both physical assault and sexual assault, and severe physical abuse of children. There are other forms as well, but the book is a contrast between both levels and costs of collective violence and interpersonal violence.
Why is it that there is such a media focus on war, and why is there not such a focus on the interpersonal violence that you studied?
I point to several factors. One is just news. What is news? That it's in the name, right? It's stuff that's new and different and change, right? It's variance. And that better describes large-scale collective violence, civil war, interstate war, episodic, suddenly happening, very dramatic. Whereas interpersonal violence is unfortunately kind of grinding along always. That's one factor. So it's not as much news, you know, it's like another year in which we have thousands of homicides. A second factor is that interpersonal violence, the major forms are relatively hidden. They're domestic, within homes. Maybe a final factor is there's a common sense that this is a matter of culture and it's just kind of a fact. It's just there, not meriting special focus.
So in this book, you've attempted to estimate the prevalence of interpersonal violence so you can compare it to the levels of violence caused by wars. As you've already mentioned, a lot of interpersonal violence happens behind closed doors. How can you do this empirically? What sort of data do you have? How well can you rely on this data?
These are great questions, and they're one of the reasons it took us so many years to do this project, which we started quite a while ago and I think thought would be done quickly. But the data problems are massive. If, for example, you tried to estimate levels of interpersonal violence, in particular, interpartner violence and severe physical abuse of children from any kind of government collection, you absolutely cannot do it. Mm-hmm. What you can do, and what we do in the book, is work from victimization surveys. So survey data, which has a lot of problems, which I'd be happy to talk more about. But we think that the coverage of countries is broad enough, and people often in public health have invested quite a bit of time and effort in figuring out how to develop batteries of questions on things like intimate partner violence and childhood discipline methods that are pretty good. So that's what we work with, victimization surveys. DHS, Demographic and Health Surveys, which was shut down, fantastic program that was run out of USAID, now no longer exists, very unfortunately, is one of those main sources. A UNICEF series of surveys called Multiple Indicator Cluster Surveys is another one of our key sources. We also do a whole bunch of work trying to do with country-specific surveys.
I guess, nevertheless, even with the best survey data, because this is something that is shameful, it isn't spoken about, we are still estimating a lot when we're thinking about those survey results.
Yes. Our suspicion is that for intimate partner violence and the data on severe physical abuse of children are underestimated. I think we also underestimate the numbers killed in civil wars. And a fair bit of the book, we're spending time looking at various data sources and studies to try to get a sense for where the largest errors are likely to be and what would happen if we adjust assumptions about those. But there's a good bit of work by people in public health who study intimate partner violence who've tried to estimate degrees of underreporting. And I think to sum it up, I'd say there's a sense that overall there's underreporting, but they do a pretty good job. It's harder to say how much underreporting there is on the child severe punishment.
What do you include? What do you categorize as violence, Jim?
Violence is a politically powerful word. And
yes,
it's used, understandably, by a lot of movements, political parties. People will say such and such is violence. And often that's used in a somewhat, or it can be used in a somewhat metaphorical way. We try, for a number of reasons, to propose a definition that's fairly close to what we think is ordinary language understanding, which is fairly narrowly focused on physical attacks by one person on the body of another in such a way as to produce what is justifiably considered harm. Mm-hmm. That's a little elaborate. Why do we need something about, is it what might justifiably be considered harm? Because there are a whole bunch of areas where there's cultural, political contestation over whether some practice is violent. Discipline practices for children would be one example. Treatment of women by their spouses is another. You know, over 100 countries don't criminalize rape by husbands, for example. So there's a lot of contestation here.
If we're just looking at levels, we'll examine costs in a second, but if we were looking at the levels of violence, what is the comparison between these two types, this interpersonal violence and violence from wars?
So let's start with deaths. We estimate that homicides are on the order of 5 times more prevalent than deaths in collective violence, which is primarily civil war. Although we look at regions, it's basically global. So both prevalence and cost estimates are given first at a global level, where we find that for the period we study, we have the data makes it possible to do it, which is 2000 to 2019. The global annual average deaths in collective violence are about 1.5 per 100,000 globally. For homicide, it's a little over 7 per 100,000. Violence against women, violence against children is far, far more often in the form of assault. Assaults are wildly more common than, say, injuries in collective violence. We estimate around 3,300 women experiencing physical assault by their partners on average each year, around 1,600 experiencing sexual assault, violence against children, over 4,000 experiencing severe physical beatings every month per 100,000 people globally.
These are shocking figures. Violence due to war, that tends to be concentrated in low-income settings. This violence that you have just listed, is it happening everywhere? What's the regional variation?
There's a strong gradient on income levels. So interpersonal violence also, like not as steep as collective violence, but still a steep gradient where the lowest, say the first third of countries on per capita income have quite a bit more of every form of interpersonal violence except suicide. Let's get back to suicide as to whether that should be considered violence or not. We do talk about it here. The middle income countries in between and the highest income countries on average lowest. The gradient is less steep than with collective violence. Interpersonal violence occurs at very high levels in some objective sense in high income countries as well. The regional variation is also substantial, although for violence against women, there is variation. There's the most of it in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia and lower income countries in those areas. There's a lot everywhere, including in high income countries in Europe.
Your numbers on the prevalence of violence against children, it's the first time I've seen figures like that collected together, and it really does make you take a breath. How did you manage to estimate that figure?
there are surveys of caregivers. And so both DHS and this multiple indicator cluster surveys have batteries on childhood discipline practices, chiefly this mixed surveys. There are also country-specific surveys when the mix don't cover it that we went around and collecting. The public health field, which we depend on a lot in this, has done tremendous work for decades now on childhood discipline practices and have a pretty standard battery of and these scales of tactics for disciplining children. And they'll ask about specific acts, like in the last month, did you use this practice in terms of disciplining kids? The UNICEF and other international organizations have released a whole lot of good reports in this area. They tend to define violent discipline of children more broadly than our definition to include, say, psychological abuse and yelling at a kid and so on, and or using demeaning words. And you'll often see in those reports estimates of like 80% of kids experiencing violent discipline. Hmm. We try to keep closer to, again, more ordinary language notion and select out really our aspiration is to try to estimate disciplinary practices, which if you saw it being done to an adult, you'd say that's assault. So we use the kind of highest end of the responses on the discipline tactics scale and still come out with these remarkably, I mean, we were also shocked. I was certainly shocked. Didn't realize how common regular beatings on the head with implements are, apparently, according to caretakers' own reports. Our use of these surveys, we end up with an estimate of about 15% of children on average each year having caretakers reporting this level of violent discipline every month.
We attach costs to this violence. There are many types of costs, but if we start with the tangible economic costs of violence, that's something that we have estimated many times for wars. What are the tangible costs for wars?
By our reckoning, they're overwhelmingly in the form of lower economic growth. Uh-huh. If you can destroy lots of capital and buildings and so on, they can be rebuilt, but they're rebuilt out of stuff that would go to growth. So we estimate that the biggest tangible costs are associated with lower economic growth rates, and we spend a good amount of time estimating counterfactual income paths for countries that had the worst civil wars. That's mainly where these estimates come from, estimating both what are the annual average losses relative to the income levels a country would have had in the period 2000-2019, and then also projecting forward, you know, if your per capita income is 5-10% lower in 2019 than it would have been without the civil war you had in that period, that's going to compound into the future. And so one of the biggest sources of, I'd say, philosophical, conceptual uncertainty here is how much weight do you want to put on the economic law, these tangible costs to people in the future, people in that country in the future, their children, et cetera. So what is the net present value of the losses due to civil war now? Mm-hmm. We're in general in this book trying to be, I guess you'd say, generous to the collective violence costs. And I think we are, if anything, biased against interpersonal violence costs overall. And one of the main ways is that we use a discount factor to value the value of lost income into the future. That's pretty standard, but also I'd say probably pretty generous.
So given those assumptions that you make, what sort of number do you come up with for tangible costs of war?
For tangible costs of war, around $3.4 trillion per year on average in the period we study.
Now, interpersonal violence, that doesn't tend to destroy buildings, as you described, those tangible costs. What would be considered the tangible economic costs of interpersonal violence?
These are also hard to estimate, and we're not the first to try to do it. Like others, the largest type of tangible costs of interpersonal violence are likely lost income. So a homicide victim, all the income they would have produced is not going to be there. For injuries and assaults, for children, evidence on the long-run effects on children who grow up with a good deal of violence also seems to have large income effects in the long run. Of course, there are other kinds. There's medical costs. There's more direct and immediate costs like medical costs. There's some judicial systems costs. There's some policing costs. But on the tangible side, those tend to be the ones that, in our reckoning and others, come out at the top.
And the comparison in numbers?
the tangible costs of collective violence much, much higher, order of magnitude higher than in our reckoning, the tangible costs of violence. Let me make one caveat there. There's a couple types of costs that we have good reason to think are very large. We just can't estimate. In a city, say, that's heavily affected by crime, we can't estimate how much better off economically people would be in the city if they had a much lower crime rate. You know, various studies here or there that are suggesting these could be quite large, and large relative to collective violence costs, given that collective violence happens in a relatively small number of countries, and even within these countries is often in a small area, whereas the number of cities around the world that are dramatically affected by gang violence, high levels of crime, is very large. So that's a tangible cost of interpersonal violence, in part, that we're not estimating and could be very large.
So, Jim, you're very clear in the book that the tangible costs, that's not the end of the conversation we have about this. There are other costs as well that we could estimate. What sort of intangibles are we thinking about?
Pain, suffering. A homicide victim loses the rest of their life. Their friends and family lose that person for years into the future. These are the primary intangible costs. People who are assaulted, victims of intimate partner violence, suffer, and their children suffer. The public health research on the long-run effects of severe physical abuse of children are really strikingly bad. I'm going to mention another category of costs that we're unable to estimate entirely, and this is, or prevalence or costs, this is sexual violence against children. Because it's so sensitive, this is not even surveyed in any way. There are studies, of course, which suggest that sexual violence against both boys and girls is pretty bad. And the long-run intangible costs of that form of violence appear to be really terrible. How do you estimate these things? This is hard. And, you know, we have a whole chapter essentially on kind of philosophical problems here. We use a method that economists and governments have been using for decades now, known as the value of a statistical life. So a large number of governments, especially OECD countries, encounter public policy problems regularly where it's like, would this health regulation be worth the cost? You know, would it be a net benefit to regulate this pollutant, given that it will, say, increase the price of some goods in the economy? So how do you assess these trade-offs between the costs of a health or safety regulation, for example, or against the lives you might save? For this purpose, they use this concept of value of statistical life, which is a set of methods used to estimate people's, on average, willingness to pay for reductions in chance of dying or chances of getting a severe injury. That's the value of statistical injury. The classic method involves looking at the amount of additional wages people require to take riskier jobs that have higher risk of injury or death, like, say, working on an oil rig. But there's a whole bunch of methods. And it sounds bad because it sounds like you're putting a price on an individual life. Until the Trump administration at least gave an order saying to stop using VSL in the bureaucracy in the U.S. executive branch, agencies were using a numbers around $11 million. Sounds like you're saying a life is worth $11 million. That's not what it means. It means that you work it out at the margin. So it's saying that on average, people would be willing to pay so much for, say, a 1% reduction in their mortality risk. But this is the way we cost the intangibles for homicides and deaths, and then we take a very small fraction of that, again, based on studies, for assaults and separately sexual assaults, which are estimated from various studies to be more costly on average.
As you say, this estimation involves value judgments, but you lay out clearly the ways in which you approach this. When you do that, how does this change our estimate of the comparative costs for personal and collective violence?
Our best estimate, we end up with intangible costs of about $30 trillion per year globally, compared to about $3.7 trillion for tangible and intangible costs of collective violence. When you look at different methods of estimating counterfactual growth paths of countries experiencing large-scale civil war, we get a range, you know, at the, anywhere from the total costs of interpersonal versus collective range from, say, 5 times greater to as much as 20 times greater. I think it could be even greater, again, given that we're constantly trying to kind of put our finger on the collective violence scale.
About $30 trillion, Jim.
$30 trillion. Now, that's largely intangible costs. So it's not as if, well, if you could have an imaginary world where all the interpersonal violence goes away, it's not saying that global GDP would be $30 trillion higher. If you could reduce interpersonal violence as a whole by 5%, then 5% of $30 trillion would be an estimate of what the world should be willing to pay for the gain in welfare that that would result in.
So as you say, it's an imaginary world where all interpersonal violence goes away. But as you've also said, there are many people who think that interpersonal violence is just a given. It's cultural. Can we reduce levels of interpersonal violence, or is it inevitable that the levels will always be like this?
I have a hard time imagining a world in which there's no interpersonal violence. I don't think it's feasible, but I absolutely think it can be significantly reduced. And we spend the second half of the book talking about or looking at programs, policy measures, natural experiments that indicate that interpersonal violence in its major forms can be significantly reduced on fairly short timescales in some cases. Pretty much every country has civil society organizations that are attempting to raise awareness and get public policy change on, for example, intimate partner violence. There are also organizations trying to change people's ideas about what are productive and effective and good ways of disciplining children. So where we started out today talking about the media focus on collective violence, I think just increasing the focus on this as a real problem that should be something that politicians and organizations in society focus on and take seriously, that's one thing. We spend a fair bit of time on police and policing, so who are, you know, of course, the first responders for quite a bit of an interpersonal violence, homicide, assault in particular. I was really struck by how under-policed so many countries are. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by that? We have a table that shows the number of police per homicide, and this has an incredible gradient with income. So in high-income countries, let's say the top third, you'll see 220 police per homicide on average. In the bottom third, you'll see like 16. In middle-income countries, it's say 20 or 30. And that's not a matter of the rich countries, the high-income countries have more money to hire police. You know, it's cheaper to hire police in a lower-income country. So this is essentially something of a measure of effort. You know, if you had the kind of homicide rates in a high-income country that you have in many lower-income countries or middle-income countries, you see increased police effort. That only works if the quality of policing is good. So it's not obvious that if you increase the number of police in a very low-income country that has a lot of problems with corruption and low training, it might not make things better. But more police and better trained, more accountable police could be really big contributors to lower interpersonal violence rates. A second factor that I was also struck by was alcohol. Hmm. Alcohol is terrible for violence. The range and types of studies on this are interesting and quite convincing. There's kind of lab experiments. Alcohol, quite a bit more than other drugs, it turns out, is really favors aggression, especially in men, not exclusively, though. At a more macro scale, there are some really striking natural experiments. Gorbachev in the Soviet Union undertook a rather effective campaign against drinking, vodka in particular, introducing a whole bunch of public policy measures in terms of sale and hours and penalties and so on that really did reduce consumption on a short timescale. And homicide rates dropped by, if I remember correctly, like 30%, which is a very, very big change in a short amount of time. There's a less clean example from South Africa during COVID where There was a period where they shut down bars and also made alcohol purchasing quite a bit more difficult. This is confounded with other COVID effects, but the homicide rates plunged 60%, which is staggering, and then went back when the bars and the liquor stores and et cetera went back to normal. Those are striking examples, but just the evidence on alcohol is really remarkable. And there's a lot of things you can do there with tax policy, with regulating bar hours, policing area, nightlife areas, and so on. There are a lot of public policy measures that could help there.
There is a large policy community that is dedicated to stopping wars and preventing wars from starting. There seems to be less attention on policy to reduce interpersonal violence. Is your argument that we should shift our priorities and maybe shift funding attention more towards interpersonal violence than collective violence?
Ideally, I'd like to see more on both. But I guess, yes, I think we make an argument, which is that the marginal returns are likely higher for spending, for example, aid spending on interpersonal violence. And that is unfortunately partially related to a pessimistic assessment about the returns to spending on various efforts to reduce collective violence. We have a chapter on what can be done to reduce collective violence, and the evidence there, I think, is strongest for peacekeeping operations, which, although there have been some well-known striking failures, overall, the evidence suggests they're a remarkably cost-effective way of reducing violence after a peace agreement and reducing the likelihood of a return to civil war. The problem is that we've entered a period in terms of international politics where it's not the 90s or the early 2000s anymore in terms of the UN Security Council and also regional rivalries in some of the areas where we have countries with really devastating and long-running civil wars stand in the way of authorization and support for peacekeeping operations. If you look at the other major forms of attempting to mitigate, reduce, prevent collective violence, the evidence is less compelling, I'd say, than for peacekeeping operations. So, I mean, we need more evidence and more experimentation, but there's like such a large range of things that can be done on intimate partner violence, changing child discipline practices, for example, that their probably returns are higher.
It's hard to imagine sometimes what that better world would be like, but can you imagine it for me? What could better policy to reduce interpersonal violence achieve, either economically or socially?
The costs of interpersonal violence are overwhelmingly in the realm of intangible, so pain, suffering, just well-being. Political scientists and economists, particularly in the development area, understandably focus on economic variables and economic growth. I hope we don't forget that the economic income is a means to an end. It's a means to well-being, to happiness, in terms of people being less afflicted by what appears to be, you know, a really major source of misery.
Jim, thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you.
If you want to read this book, it will be one of the more remarkable books that you read this year. It is called Worse Than War, The Global Costs of Violence. The authors, Anke Hoefler and James Fearon. It is published by the Princeton University Press. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, you know what I'm going to say, please subscribe, follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We are there. Our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where you also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you enjoyed this episode, then please share it with somebody else and also leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.